Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Meg Terrell.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
Our co-host, Damian Garde, is out this week.
It's Thursday, March 11th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
Which country makes better COVID vaccines, the US or the UK? Natasha Loader, the health policy editor at The Economist and a London resident, has strong feelings about this question and many others. She'll share with us while also making Adam eat some crow.
Gee, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It was.
Next, we'll chat with STAT reporter Casey Ross about the downfall of Watson Health, IBM's failed AI healthcare initiative.
Lastly, synthetic biology. What is it? STAT reporter Megan Akashevan will explain.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Angus McCauley, the Chief Revenue Officer of STAT. There have been tremendous leaps forward in recent years in digital health, but there's still a long way to go. I'm here with Chris Benko, the CEO of Conexa, a software company dedicated to making clinical research more agile, safer, and friendlier for the people who participate. Chris, what are some of the obstacles preventing expanded use of digital biomarkers in clinical trials?
Thanks, Angus. Utilizing wearables and sensors for vaccine and drug trials involves more than just selecting cutting-edge digital tools. You need to make sure that new digital biomarkers are collecting valid, reliable, and compliant data. At Conexa, we are focused on building tools that will provide the most meaningful patient data. For more information, visit conexahealth.com. That's Konexa health.com.
In the international race for COVID vaccinations, the UK was the first to a key milestone. It was the first country to authorize a fully tested COVID-19 vaccine, the one from Pfizer. And the country has also embraced a strategy of spacing out vaccine doses to cover more people with a first shot.
The UK has now given 34% of its population at least one dose, and about 2% have been fully vaccinated. That's according to Bloomberg's vaccine tracker. Here in the US, we've given 18% of our population at least one shot, and just less than 10% are fully vaccinated.
So to discuss who does it better, we invited our friend Natasha Loader, health policy editor of The Economist and host of The Economist's new podcast, The Jab, to join us today. Natasha, welcome to The Read Out Loud.
Hey guys, I'm so pleased to be here.
So Natasha, we have to get to the most important question of the day first, and that is Team Meghan and Harry or Team Royals?
Oh, Team Meghan and Harry, no question whatsoever. They're awesome. I love them. They got out. It's great. Good for them.
Speaking of ancient British institutions, let's discuss Oxford University and its COVID-19 vaccine partnered with AstraZeneca. There have been very different approaches to this vaccine in the UK versus the US. In the UK, it's a source of national pride and is already being administered widely, while in the US, we're waiting on data from a phase 3 trial run here. In fact, Adam even nominated AstraZeneca CEO Pascal Soriot as among the worst biopharma CEOs of 2020, writing, quote, "Like a baby boomer dancing on TikTok, it's impossible to look at AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine efforts without a feeling of disbelief bordering on disgust. Despite a promising start, the vaccine program, which is partnered with the UK's Oxford University, has been one misstep after another, almost all self-inflicted," unquote. So that was in December, and more data have come out since then. So Natasha, does Adam need to bite his tongue?
Wait a second. Before Natasha answers, I want to say that I was pretty proud of that TikTok.
That's why I quoted it.
That I used. Okay. All right. All right, Natasha, go ahead.
I mean, Adam needs to bite his tongue about all sorts of things. I mean, in your intro, Meg, you referred to how we were the first to approve the Pfizer vaccine. And I can remember having a sort of epic slapdown from Adam on Twitter saying, oh, you totally overhyped that story, Natasha, when I said that there was this big news coming. And he said something like, oh, yeah, big news tweets are like trailers for summer movie blockbusters. They rarely live up to expectations. And the next day, just out of pure sort of, I don't know, maybe spite, maybe it was, I went and looked at all the headlines and all the newspapers, and they were all saying that the UK had done this first with the Pfizer vaccine. So I kind of felt quite justified.
I admit it, Natasha, you are 100% correct.
Thank you. That's really sweet of you. Now, look, on the Astra vaccine, I would say, look, there's no question the data has been messier than everyone would have liked. And certainly, there was some confusion in the initial press conference that made it harder to report. And I remember, in fact, after the press conference, I was being asked a lot of questions. You know, is it 60%? Is it 70%? Is it 90% efficacy? And I stuck with 70% at the time for the simple reason that I didn't know whether the this sort of special half dose group had been predefined. I mean, I know it's a bit of a nerdy sort of discussion to have. All that said, I always had quite a lot of confidence that it would get sorted out, confidence that I think was not shared by everyone. I remember there was a piece in Wired almost maybe a day or so afterwards, which was very skeptical about the AstraZeneca data. Again, a lot of people just wanted to give it a good kicking for various reasons. And I've always felt the need to just be a little bit more careful because, you know, well, we know now, and it was clear to me then, that we would need people to be confident en masse on this vaccine. And so even though there were some problems with the data, if they could get ironed out, it seemed that it would probably not matter in the longer term.
So, Natasha, it's my turn to quote you.
Okay? Oh, go on. Uh-oh.
So last month, you tweeted, here's a quote, "I am ridiculously pleased that Oxford has done a big," and then you use the stick out your tongue emoji, "to all the vaccine doomsayers." So I wonder, do you feel like you were rooting more for the homegrown UK vaccine than any others?
I'm going to get on my high horse again. I've been rooting for this vaccine from day one because there was a commitment to creating a great vaccine at huge volumes, about 3.5 billion doses around the world at low cost. And if you look back at our history with outbreak medicines, whether it's HIV antiretrovirals or with H1N1 vaccines, the lesson we had from those incidences was that rich countries get medicines and poor ones don't. And what have we done this time round? Almost at the same time, simultaneously in rich countries and poor, we have launched this medicine. That's a historic first. Yes, it's a British vaccine, and I have some pride in that. Obviously, Astra is an Anglo-Swedish company. It's an international global pharmaceutical company. You know, I'm sure you guys think that Pfizer is an American company. Well, guess what? It's only American because you wouldn't let it go to Ireland. So, you know, it's like, yes, I'm pleased. I'm proud that we supported that vaccine from an early stage, and I'm proud that it's getting delivered around the world today.
So how do people in the UK view the US's approach to vaccines and our vaccination strategy?
I think there is an acceptance that different countries go different routes. I know that many Americans have kind of looked down their noses at the way we've done things. And I wouldn't say that the same has been true in reverse. I do think that you could have done more to expand the distance between the first dose and the second dose. I think that we took a calculated risk on extending the dosing. And I know that the purists will say, well, you didn't have the data. Well, maybe, maybe not. There was a bit of data for the AZ vaccine, and we do know generally for vaccines that a longer dosing schedule is generally better. Now, that's not a lot to go on, but I think, you know, we're in a pandemic and British people are quite pragmatic. And also we have a much stronger sense of our society and societal needs in Britain than perhaps in America. You know, when we had the debate in Britain, and we did, I would put it to people like this. I would say, okay, you've got two doses of vaccine. Which of your two parents are you going to give it to? Or are you going to give them one dose each? And that kind of really put it in perspective for a lot of people. Now, it is a gamble that has paid off. I think they did take a bigger gamble with the extending the Pfizer dosing because they had no data basically for that. And the other thing just to bear in mind is that when we took that decision, you know, our deaths, and you must recall, of course, we're having a terrible outbreak. Our deaths were so high that when I looked at, you know, if I multiply out, you know, the size of the UK to the size of America, we were losing a kind of equivalent to about 4,500 people a day at that time. So you kind of need to understand that. It's like, how bad a public health decision could that be? How much of a mistake could that be for you to actually cause more death by extending the dosing? It's kind of hard to see that you could get that decision wrong if you're losing that many people.
Maybe we can all agree that the United States and the UK are doing better than Europe.
Yes, we can. I mean, I think in terms of procurement, you've done brilliantly. I think your distribution saddens me, I have to say, the way that it's been done. And I think that's a consequence of your health system. I mean, the fact that you know, 65-year-olds are having to sort of go onto an event website to try and get a vaccine dose, like they're trying to get Barbra Streisand concert tickets. It's kind of shocking to me, I have to say. And, you know, we have a list of every single 80-year-old in the country with their comorbidities and their 70-year-olds. And, you know, they get a text message from their GP or from their doctor, come in for your vaccine. They're not having to sort of, you know, try and complete online for life-saving medicines. So I think, you know, while your science and technology has been brilliant, it's the distribution has really kind of revealed some of the sort of underlying fault lines in your system. And that's not to say that Britain is perfect. There's lots of things that we did absolutely terribly wrong, from the science to test and trace and things like that.
You know, the government here has also been using the Defense Production Act to great approval in this country to prioritize vaccines. But has this been having an impact internationally?
Yes. So I've just spent the last couple of days in a Chatham House meeting with vaccine suppliers, vaccine supply chain people, governments and the like. And there is a growing sense of disquiet at how the Defense Production Act is having an impact on the movement of key critical items. And, you know, just to let, you know, just to sort of explain, you know, vaccine supply chains are global, you know, although the US has tried to be quite independent when it comes to, you know, all the sort of doodads that you need, you know, actually things come from everywhere, from Europe, whether it's tubing, sterilization equipment, bio bags and things like that. And the Defense Production Act is definitely causing, you know, delays to everything from raw materials to key bits of equipment. And so what we could get into, and this is really the concern that was raised in the meeting, we could get into a situation where there are sort of tit for tat export controls, and that actually could essentially kind of gum up the whole vaccine production. It's, you know, it's worth highlighting, I think, that, you know, except for mRNA, all the other vaccines are made using the same equipment that you use to make monoclonal antibodies. And so if we don't sort this out, this is clearly going to have an impact on the production of other drugs, you know, life-saving drugs, monoclonal antibodies. How can it not? You know, anything can go in a biobag. And so if you're trying to get up from 3.5 billion doses of vaccine or whatever it is we produce annually to, you know, 14 billion, right, that's a big deal.
So on your podcast this week, you have an interview with the organizer of the world's first challenge trial for a COVID-19 vaccine. The idea being volunteers are exposed directly to the virus. These were advocated as a way to speed up vaccine development. But, you know, now we have, you know, multiple vaccines that are already authorized around the world. What's the point of this now?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I would love to read their application to their ethics review board, and I'd love to have been a fly on the wall when they had the discussion. I mean, clearly they've convinced someone that the benefits are worthwhile. I mean, I think we can all see that there's a risk there, right? Even if you take young, healthy people, you know, there's the risk of long COVID, there's the risk of complications. We don't really understand this disease. We do human challenge trials with diseases that we understand much better and that we have rescue therapies for. So, you know, there are all the reasons that we do them. I would say that Britain has had a lot more experience doing human challenge trials over the years than many other countries, and probably were a bit less squeamish about them. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it goes back to the fact that we do have much more of a sort of sense of, you know, community and society when it comes to healthcare. I don't know. I'm kind of just, you know, guessing really here. I have a hunch. I mean, I would just ask this question, Adam. Do you think this is a trial that could ever get off the ground in the US? And if not, why not?
Well, I think, you know, it just seems like in the current situation now where we have vaccines available, like, why would you go into a trial like that? Like, I guess, you know, you could propose a trial and maybe scientifically it's justified, and maybe even from an ethical standpoint it's okay, with obviously with safeguards in place. But like, as a potential participant, why would you want to enroll in a trial like that?
I suppose, look, here's what you might get out of it. If they come away knowing what the correlates of protection are, right? And then you can then apply that information so that basically you never need to do a phase 3 trial again for a COVID vaccine, then that is actually kind of quite useful. And, you know, remember that most vaccines that we do approve just generally are done on correlates of protection these days because they're kind of revisions and we don't rerun the phase three trials. So you could argue it from that point of view.
Natasha, thanks for joining us.
Oh, is that it? Oh my God, I thought you were going to be much tougher on me. I was ready for a real roasting.
You know, we're in and out in this podcast. You know, we give you a few minutes and then the hook, you're out of here. IBM launched its Watson Health business with an audacious promise to revolutionize the practice of medicine with artificial intelligence. But years later, and after billions of dollars in investments, Watson Health is a failed enterprise. Last month, IBM put the unit up for sale. So what went wrong?
A Stat investigation published this week points the finger squarely at IBM leadership, which focused Watson Health priorities on splashy, truth-stretching marketing campaigns and short-term financial goals. What IBM did not do is invest in the time-consuming technical work required to build a sustainable AI business that could match all the hype.
Stat reporter Casey Ross has been covering IBM and Watson Health for years. He co-wrote this week's investigative piece with fellow Stat reporter Mario Aguilar, and it's based on internal IBM documents and interviews with former employees. Casey's here to tell us more. Welcome to the podcast, Casey.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So, Casey, you know, until I read your story, I had forgotten that IBM's push into AI in healthcare started 10 years ago. But as you report, it didn't take long for those lofty ambitions to diverge from reality. Where did it start going wrong?
Yeah, you know, IBM came out of the box very aggressively marketing this product in a whole bunch of different domains: cancer, genomic data analysis, analyzing data for hospitals and insurers, clinical trial recruitment. And to be fair to IBM, everybody was lapping it up, right? I mean, including the media, which was writing glowing stories about Watson. The problem was that its technical capabilities never really caught up with the marketing. It wasn't able to deliver on its promises in all of those different domains. And this pretty yawning credibility gap opened between what it was saying in its press releases and in its marketing, and then what it was able to actually deliver in the market. And it just wasn't able to recover from that.
So cancer was a big focus for Watson Health. IBM ran commercials in which it claimed that its AI system could outthink cancer. But you interviewed a former employee who said it was all made up. The actual data never supported the cancer marketing, right?
They never really engaged in studies that supported the notion that the use of its product could significantly improve outcomes, or certainly that it could save lives. I mean, the science just never really supported that from what they were able to generate. And beyond that, the marketing also really technically overstated how the product works. It doesn't read your medical records, for example, and form its own conclusions that would drive forward knowledge or help personalize treatments. Really, what it's doing is it's referencing recommendations that are baked in by several dozen physicians that trained it at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. That's very different from automatically reading data and producing solutions or recommendations that that reach beyond sort of existing knowledge about cancer.
IBM was very good at negotiating deals for Watson Health and signing a ton of partnerships, you know, which it liked to tout in press releases. What did you learn about those partnerships and business initiatives after the publicity died down?
We learned that it really just wasn't able to execute in all those different domains. One of the core ones is hospital analytics and insurance companies, where they were trying to feed them insights from data that would be provided by those entities. Early on, Watson Health acquired four companies: Truven, Exploris, Phytel, and Merge Healthcare. All of them provided different kinds of data: clinical, claims data, imaging data in the case of Merge. And the problem was that you need to be able to integrate those data into a common format in which they can be read by the AI to be able to deliver on those insights. That was always the promise, and it was really the core business. That was the business that was going to drive most of the revenue. IBM was never able to technically integrate them. They never released a dedicated cloud repository in which the data could be collected. So a lot of those partnerships that it signed early on with hospitals and insurance companies and others just really went nowhere.
And as we noted at the top, Watson Health has been a disappointment for IBM, and it's being put up for sale. Yet elsewhere, there are other tech companies like Google, Amazon, and Microsoft, which are investing heavily to bring AI into healthcare. Are there lessons in Watson Health's demise that these newer entrants can learn to avoid making the same mistakes?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of lessons. I think the first is let the science do the talking, not your CEO, not your press release. I think you have to go to this with some level of humility in talking about what the AI can do. And you've really got to let the technology perform. You need to produce data and science and engage in that science in order to deliver on the promises in a way that's going to bring clients and customers to you. You just can't do that by over-marketing. The other thing I would say is that having a product that performs technically, that does what you say it's going to do, is one thing, but it's just an entire different thing to integrate that product into drug discovery or into clinical care to provide insights or deliver treatment recommendations for something like cancer. There's just a whole different domain of understanding the implementation of those products and how they are going to work with existing practices that has to be done in order to get these products to work in the industries or in the sectors in which it's trying to be implemented.
So, Casey, do you feel like IBM deserves any credit for its role as an early mover in AI in healthcare?
Yes, I would say absolutely. I mean, they were a pioneer in this space. They came before so many other companies in trying to implement AI. You know, there's sort of that analogy of the pioneer that they face on the frontier, a lot of hidden dangers that can cause the pioneer a lot of harm. In this case, I think that analogy doesn't really pan out because although IBM was a pioneer, it wasn't those inherent dangers that really caused it to fall apart or to suffer here. It was its own self-inflicted wounds. It was, you know, overreaching on the marketing, not engaging in the science. And so I think those are important lessons to take away from this going forward.
And how did IBM respond to your reporting?
Well, typically, you know, this was years of reporting, really. We started back in 2017, and then they sort of engaged, but at a certain point, they sort of stopped engaging and just would issue, you know, statements, basically. And that's what we got in this case. They were essentially just saying, well, we're proud of what we did. We were a pioneer in this space. You know, we're an early mover. At this point, IBM, you know, doesn't seem to be engaging to try to build, you know, Watson Health or even its Watson AI engine in healthcare any longer.
Casey, great reporting and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Nothing about synthetic biology or even know what the term means. But if you've been vaccinated with either of the mRNA-based COVID vaccines, or if you hope to be soon, you're being protected in part thanks to synthetic biology.
Thankfully, Stat reporter Megan Akashevan has become our resident expert on SynBio, as it is fondly called. She recently authored an in-depth report on the subject that is available for sale on Stat's website. And yes, that is a shameless promotional plug.
Meghna is here to help us better understand SynBio and how the field is evolving. Hello, Meghna.
Hi.
So let's start with a definition. What is synthetic biology and how does it differ from genetic engineering, which is a term that I think more people know and understand?
Synthetic biology is sort of a famously hazy term, but we could say that synthetic biology tries to re-engineer nature from the bottom up. It basically pieces together, you know, the most basic molecules like pieces of DNA or RNA to create biological machinery. So basically, instead of tweaking something that already exists, like what we'll see in genetic engineering, like you don't necessarily just take something that exists like a stretch of code and then change a couple pieces of it. What synthetic biologists do is they build that whole stretch of code completely from scratch. I think that the way that they like to define it is, you know, synthetic biologists do take that bottom-up engineering approach, whereas bioengineers or genetic engineers do something more of a top-down approach where they take something that exists and changes it.
So we mentioned that the mRNA-based COVID vaccines, those are the ones from Pfizer and Moderna, rely in part on SynBio. How so?
So the COVID-19 vaccines from those companies contain synthetic stretches of, custom-built mRNA. And those bits of mRNA that are found in the vaccine end up prompting a person's cells to create a protein fragment that resembles part of the virus and helps, kick up an immune response. That custom portion of mRNA, it's all synthetic biology. That was the technique was invented after, H1N1 spread around the world a little bit. And people were trying to rapidly develop a vaccine. And they discovered that, piecing together portions of RNA that, mimicked what exists in nature ended up working quite well in a vaccine. So, yeah, it's a fairly synthetic vaccine.
So what are some of the other medical applications for SynBio?
Well, CAR T therapies are becoming more and more popular in terms of like treating patients, but also just in terms of research. There scientists are trying to develop better ways to re-engineer cells to attack cancer. And using synthetic biology, some researchers and companies are creating really novel types of immune cells that can attack cancer that just do things that would never actually happen in nature. But, the synthetic biology process allows really specific and unique alterations to attack cancer. Other forms are, microbiome therapeutics, where, again, you re-engineer a cell to do what you want it to do in the gut to, create some sort of homeostasis or attack a pathogen or something like that. There are a couple of microbiome therapeutics that are in the works. There are a lot of diagnostic tools that are being developed with synthetic biology now. And then tissue engineering. We hear about the organs that are being developed for transplant inside pigs. And that is actually an aspect of synthetic biology right there, because you are changing something that exists in nature with a very specific end, creating something from scratch.
So your report highlights some of the emerging companies in the SynBio field. We won't ask you to name them all, but tell us about one.
I thought BitBio was kind of a fun company. It's in Cambridge in the UK. And they are basically, again, engineering cells from scratch, but these are human cells. And so what they're doing is identifying the sort of growth factors that need to be in the environment to change cells from your basic stem cell into something completely specialized in the body. And they're actually trying to create every single type of cell in the body. I mean, they're pretty far away from doing that, but they've succeeded with synthesizing certain types of cells in the body. And it's kind of a fun company. So
once again, you can purchase a copy of Megana's report. It's titled Understanding Synthetic Biology on Stat's website. Megana, thanks for your time today.
Sure. It was a fun effort.
That does it for another episode of The Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Embonato and Alyssa Ambrose, and our executive producer is Rick Burke.
And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode and what you didn't like. And who makes a better COVID vaccine, Americans or Brits? You can do all that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.